You are listening to the cycling podcast Brevet in association with Rafa.
I'm Richard Moore and this is Lionel Burney, and we are two-thirds of the cycling podcast. We're very honoured and unfortunate to be, that sounded like unfortunate, it was actually and fortunate, to be sponsored by Rafa. Very lucky to have had that relationship with Rafa for the last 18 months, continuing next year as well. And we've done a few events here, but never seen this place quite so packed. So that's a great sign, and hope you all enjoy our chat with Phil just now. Out of interest, how many of you have ridden a song call with Phil? A lot. Quite a lot of you, about maybe 30-40%. We're recording this tonight because we recently, our focus is professional cycling in our regular podcast, but we recently, well, over the last year or so, I think we've become aware, haven't we, of a real growing interest in endurance cycling and riding that's not necessarily racing. And we recently did a pilot episode of what we called the cycling podcast Brevet, which is a very clumsy and unsubtle attempt to get Rafa to sponsor a series next year. We imagine a series of six or so episodes next year, really looking at this area of the sport, and this hopefully will feature as one of those episodes, because you really sort of embody that, Phil. Before we go on with the questions, maybe Lionel, you can run through the stats of the 1,000 calls.
Well, I can, yeah, Richard. When I first read about the 1,000 call on Twitter, I thought somebody had just, you know, added an extra O by mistake. I just couldn't quite get my head around, you know, how somebody would start thinking about tackling 1,000 climbs. I mean, I'm not really built for the mountains. I'm much more a flatland rider. And just the other speakers before we came on talking about testing themselves and coming to grief on the road, my own experience of that would be the Paris-Roubaix Sportive, 270 kilometres. And I always sum that up by saying the first 8 hours were fine, but the last hour took 3 hours. And I think that's the kind of, you know, that's the kind of, so I can kind of identify with biting off more than you can chew. Unfortunately, I usually end up on the side of the road in a bit of a mess, whereas people like Phil just keep on going. But the 1,000 mountains or cols were climbed in 100 days of riding between May and October. 27 rest days, which seems too many to me, but I mean, what do I know? Although they weren't spent resting, we'll ask Phil what he did do on those rest days, because I imagine the logistics were just as much of a challenge as the riding. 445,000 metres of climbing, an average of 4,500 a day, give or take. I've rounded that up, Phil, just to make it sound better.
Round it down.
4,500.
Yeah, go on, I'll give it to
you. Yeah, you know, we're splitting hairs here, aren't we, really? 19,460 kilometres ridden, an average of 194 a day. The highest point was the Col de l'Isérin in the Northern Alps. 50 climbs were longer than 20 kilometres, and 16 borders were crossed, which means that this kind of challenge after Brexit will be almost impossible for British people. But an absolutely awesome achievement, Phil. I mean, first of all, the obvious question, for those who don't know, including myself, really, is you know, how did you come up with it? And really, why did you come up with it?
The why question. There were several whys. I suppose that I had to... the first thing was to convince the people around me, namely my wife, Claire, and that guy over there, Walter, who is... we tend to ride together quite a lot, and it's... he's my foil in a way. I need to test ideas with him, and I watched very carefully when I first mentioned the idea to him. There's not much that frightens him, but he twitched, and he said, okay, right, but you're going to have to get someone to manage the events for you, because there's no way you can manage the events and ride. I mean, you can't do it. Yeah, of course. Now I've got that sorted. I'm going to get someone, you know, to manage all the events. So I sort of got through that first stage of convincing the people immediately around me that I could do it. I sent an email over to James and Simon saying, this is my latest idea. And that was easy. I got exactly the reply that I was expecting. That's mad. That's crazy. That's amazing. We're it. So that was good. So we're getting there. And then I had to actually give it a little bit more of justification. And so I had to think a little bit more. And it's undeniable that to begin with, initially, it was simply using another birthday, quite a big birthday, as I used the excuse when I was 50, for a big moment of self-indulgence in a passion. And hoping that, you know, 60 being a massive milestone, I could use it to do even more than I had when I was 50.
The obvious thing would have been just, you know, 60 calls or something, you know, or, you know, I mean, but maybe that's just the way my mind works.
Yeah, you're right. I did actually consider, I looked at, you know, what, 50, 300, 60, 600, and it didn't sound quite as good. I prefer decimals, I think, and there was something about, you know, song calls, 10 days, 100, yeah, I've got to stick with the 10s. I just like the idea of it, and then I started to analyse it a little bit more, and you know, of course, there were actually quite a lot of reasons. Very briefly, one was that I wanted to juxtapose the 10 different routes that I designed together to make one long journey, hopefully in the interest of really discovering the character of each one in a different way that I possibly would if I was just doing one normally, you know, and then having a break and then coming back and then going to the Alps and then coming back. So there was that, just make it one long continuous journey. The other one was that the idea was that I would actually just do the riding, not the managing the events, because I, for 9 years, I had managed the event and I had spent quite a time looking after the people who needed looking after, you know, sort of the shepherd quite often, which was good fun, but I just wanted for once to actually ride it for myself, for the pure experience, physical experience of the riding. So that was number two. And number three, which actually definitely became the main reason and justification as time went along this year, was that I wanted it as a reason to bring as many riders who had ridden Soncol's events before or who were new to it, but to bring them together and to create a sense, an even more enhanced sense of community and sharing. And it was something, the sharing thing is really where I hit the real reason. This idea of not doing something just for myself, but actually in a way also feeding off the feedback I got and the support that I got from my co-riders.
So something you mentioned in the film was this sense, this idea of reconnecting with a feeling or an idea that you had I guess when you started cycling, because you came to cycling pretty late. You took it up when you were 40, didn't you?
Yep.
And I guess as you explored the limits of what was possible for you, you reached a sort of plateau and wanted to, as I spoke to you earlier on, scare yourself is what you said. So sort of give yourself a challenge that you maybe weren't 100% sure that you could actually do. So that was a factor as well, wasn't it, in setting the 1,000 calls?
That's true. Wanting to get back to a genuine feeling about it. I suppose that what people seem to get from the event is the fact that I've created it in a way that it is something that's that is a massive achievement in itself just to complete. And so you've almost, just by doing it and being there, you've already got the medal in a way. There's no more, once you're there, there's no winning to be done because you've already won by just being there. And therefore, where does it go then? Because, you know, inevitably there is a competitive nature to any form of sport. And there always will be, it's undeniable. But it's not going to be the focus of why you're there. So then it becomes something that instead of competing against each other, we're actually helping each other. Because we all know, it doesn't matter, you know, whether you take whether your final hour of the day takes an hour or takes three. You know, it's you're there, all there together at the end of the day, and there's an immense feeling of bonding and respect that is developed amongst riders. And that is really, I think, essentially to do with the fact that you can't hide. Everyone has had to dig deep, and we all have bad moments, and we help each other through those bad moments. So it's this sort of collective rather than competitive challenge that we've all taken on.
Do you think you could have ridden 1,000 calls on your own, you know, rather than with groups?
The answer is undoubtedly yes, although that seems a bit pretentious.
You're right.
Funnily enough, I never for once doubted myself, either before or during, in terms of the cycling itself. It was the real battle became a mental one. Mentally, because I was paying the price of almost 5 months with 5 hours a night's sleep, and every waking hour was either riding or managing logistics or people. And so I was dealing with mental fatigue. But if I had been on my own, I also think that the hardest thing would have been the mental bit, because, you know, I don't mind being on my own and listening to my own thoughts, but after a while, they tend to get a bit boring. And I think I would have had a hard time just mentally staying focused on the job at hand.
Richard and I cover professional racing, and it strikes me that this the endurance riding ethos is almost sort of a callback to the very first days of you know, racing bikes, the first Tour de France and Giro d'Italia and so on. But in terms of, you know, plotting your route and coming up with all of the 10 different challenges, first of all, what do you define as a col? And how did you go about designing these routes? Were there any climbs? I mean, the list of climbs, for anyone who watches professional racing, you know, there's some very, very famous climbs, obviously, and some more obscure ones, and some that I'm not too sure have featured too often in the Grand Tours, perhaps. But how did you go about designing the routes, and what were you looking for? And were you trying to make it as easy as possible between... So you've answered that one.
Okay, so for those who don't know, what is a col is not the top. It's a passage in between two higher points. So it's like a saddle, basically. The more interesting point is, who calls a col? And I've now started naming cols. Sod it, you know, it's... because there's a thing called the Club de Saint Col in France that is very much a clubman's club, and they get quite annoyed about what is a col and what is not a col, you know. And in the end, if you've been climbing for 10 kilometres and you get a good view at the top, that's a col. So I suppose it's, at times it could be called the Saint Climbs Challenge as opposed to Saint Col. But we're missing the point, aren't we? No. So it's about climbing 100 big hills, let's say. So how do I put those together? That is the really interesting part of the process. I remember we did a talk in the RCC at Amsterdam at the beginning of this year with Walter, actually, and we're there and we're talking. We had questions about the upcoming ride. And there was a guy there who was with Ollie, actually, in the Pyrenees last year, and who'd done a Saint Col and who was telling people what it was like. And I got quite a nice compliment there, I have to say. He said that I'm a bit like a Michelin chef. And the point he was making was that I use ingredients that anyone can find. You know, I use the same roads. I don't build them for the event. You know, they're there. It's just that what I enjoy is the way I put them together and what I'm trying to do. And I really do, because I, over the time, you know, I might come round to that, sort of the relationship I built up with the road. It's a bit weird, but, you know, I have. And it's all to do with that and how I have learned what makes an exceptional day on the bike, as opposed to just a really good or really hard ride. They're not hard for the sake of being hard. What I enjoy is putting together, and I really find that I would have quite liked to be a musician in my life, and I really admire musicians, and the thing I like the most about them is the way that they compose. And I feel, honestly, that when I design a stage while I'm composing. In other words, I'm looking at it and I know exactly the states of mind, let alone body, that so-and-so climb and descend and the juxtaposition of the next climb to that one, I know what that's going to create as an effect on mind and body. And it's really just a development of that theme. And when I can end them with either a flying 25k descent, that's the easy, good ending, because you know that everyone comes in with a smile on their face. When I have the more sadistic type of moments, and I can find a really tough climb to finish on with a hotel at the top, that's nirvana.
I mean, given that you've completed this incredible challenge this year while also being the guy in charge and guiding people and looking after them and taking on all their problems and concerns and reassuring them, it sort of links a bit to my earlier question, but that must take you out of yourself a little bit. And I think any of us who've suffered on the bike, a long day on the bike, your mind becomes your biggest enemy, doesn't it? And those thoughts that you mentioned. And I wondered if that aspect of it is something that perhaps makes it easier to cope with for you to deal with. It obviously adds a lot of work and a lot of stress. I wonder if that element, the idea that you're also responsible for these other people, just takes you out of yourself and maybe saves you from yourself a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally essential and central to the whole experience. There's a guy, Jeff Wills, he landed from Toronto to be here this evening and he's flying back on Saturday. There's a guy, a girl, Mickey, wherever she is, she had a really bad crash a week ago, had an operation on Monday to enable her to fly from Madrid to be here tonight and is flying back. There are people here who have, other people who have travelled a long way. Mark has travelled from Edinburgh to be here. There are people who, most of whom, kept it a surprise to be here. Those are people who, for me, are symbols of what this event is about. I mean, it's very flattering, but it's about the event, it's about what happens out there on the road. It's not about, it's not directly me. There have been many times over the years when I've been so lucky to meet extraordinary people on the road. This is the thing that is so fascinating. It's also really one of the why questions at the beginning is, what is this phenomenon of cycling that has swept through our society now and has caused so many bike widows and obsessional males to be out there? And it is at the same time something so simple and linked to something so basic in ourselves, and yet at the same time, I think it's filling in something that is becoming rarer in our society. And one of those things is genuine sharing and connectivity with other people and with something much greater than ourselves. And part of what I get out of cycling is being in communication with something greater than ourselves. And the mountains epitomise that, obviously. And so when you're cycling together with other people who are all connecting, you know, with each other, and we're experiencing something that we all know, we may not be able to define, but we all know that is a pretty impressive thing, and this is really why we're here, that's an amazing source of energy.
You talked about finding a steep climb to end the day with, up to a hotel, presumably serving good food and wine, hopefully the hotel. So you must be aware that the riders are probably cursing you quite a lot of the time. You may well be cursing yourself at times. But the thing, as you're talking about the actual experience of riding, that strikes me as well, coming from experiencing a lot of these climbs on kind of Tour de France or Giro d'Italia day, when there's a lot of clutter, there's spectators and cars and the landscape is kind of altered and blighted a little bit. I mean, what for you, is the landscape an important part of the whole deal? The fact that you are at one with the climbs, you're out there, the views are beautiful. How important is that to you? And if you have a sort of top three Phil Deaker climbs, which three would be the top three? And a quick fire on that one.
Okay, yeah. All right, so first question I'll answer. There's two people in this room who were on the very first Song Calls event. They are three, actually, and they were witnesses to this is my first event, and we'd had an interesting situation on stage two, which involved riders, one of which I think was Bob, being stranded in a snowstorm on the top of Galibier, and me trying to work out how to get 33 other riders to Briançon, which is the other side of Galibier, which was suffering a whiteout. And but the other interesting moment of that event was stage nine, end of stage nine. A few very wise riders had spotted that we'd already done 100 colts, yet we still had a day to ride. I hadn't spotted that myself, except that I always deliberately added a few more in just in case we did have roadblocks or whatever. But I explained to them that actually there was a really good reason why we had to do the stage as I designed it, because they spotted a shortcut, really, and so they could get home early and have a few ice creams instead of right into the ride, making it easier again, you know? That's not the way. And so, anyway, I put it to the vote. I said, you know, how many people don't want to ride the full route tomorrow? All but Graham, bless him, who works for RAFA, was the only RAFA staff there. Thank goodness. I had one sport, was pretty much the only one to say, you know, no, we'll do the shortcut. I said, well, hang on, can we vote again tomorrow morning? Just sleep on it. You know, you're tired and it's been a long day. And I also said, by the way, the route's not changing next year. There's a very good reason why the route is like it is. So it'll be the same next year. So unfortunately, you won't have done the full, you know, full route. But if that doesn't bother you, then it doesn't bother me. And we came down for breakfast. I'm not lying, am I? This is genuine. I came down for breakfast, and in fact, hey, everyone wanted to do the whole full route. And when they came up the way that they might have been able to come down, there were big smiles on their face, and they all said, okay, Phil, you win, okay. And it was because the views were amazing. You had quite long views over the biggest hole in France, which is called the Col Naval, and it's a kilometre down. That's a roundabout way about answering the importance of views, because in fact, really, for me, the importance of views is, there's a thing, I've sort of found words for it, and there is a thing called the underview and the overview. And the underview, yeah, do you want to know? Yeah, can I tell everyone? Yeah. So the underview is what goes on the lower slopes of a climb. So generally speaking, at the beginning of a climb, the views are shorter, and maybe because of that, partly, we have more immediate concerns and worries, such as, God, I hope it's not going to be too cold at the top. Have I got enough to eat? Can I hold on to the wheels in front of me? All that stuff. And then gradually, as you go up to the top, the views get longer. And you know what happens? Thoughts get loftier. You have lost that heavy feeling you had at the bottom, and you're attaining a feeling of a lightheadedness, possibly because of delirious fatigue. But generally, because you know you're up there and you are seeing the world below you as a little Legoland, and you are treated to views that I can remember so well. A particular view, Tim Mitchell is here, we shared that together in the Cevennes, where we could probably see about 12 different horizons, you know, like one bam, bam. And when you're in a situation like that, there is no way that you can have other things than thoughts about the bigger picture. That's it, it's the bigger picture. So that's just an example of where I think we draw enormous strength and motivation from climbing high. It's certainly one of the reasons why I sort of find it quite easy to start yet another climb. Definitely views have a more than just a role of being aesthetically pleasing. They definitely have a role on the psyche. Which is quite useful when you're, you know, after 15Ks of grinding, you tend to wonder, why actually, you know, am I doing this? And you stop asking yourself that question and just contemplate, and you get the answer.
Can I just, before you do your top three, can I put a famous quote from Robert McFarlane to you about climbing and why people climb? And he was talking more about sort of mountaineering and so on, but he said people who travel to the tops of mountains are half in love with themselves and half in love with oblivion. Is that something you would recognise?
No.
Okay. I'll let Robert McFarlane know. But what I mean is, a mountain, it makes you feel both big and small, doesn't it? I think that's what you're describing.
Yeah.
It takes you out yourself.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. For sure. But there's also a thing. Maybe this is the point to place this one. There's a thing about the mountains that both reassure and threaten. Mm. And that's the bit I love. I love feeling vulnerable, and I do prefer blue skies and sun and dry when I'm cycling, but I kind of get a bit excited about the idea of this is actually going to be a bit uncomfortable and epic, as long as it doesn't become dangerous. But, you know, I do, because it's all to do with feeling this contact with something that makes the rest of it all a bit irrelevant, if only temporarily. So I guess I kind of... I'm not that conscious of myself. That's why I enjoy it. You just forget yourself. You're part of something bigger. And I don't think that's oblivion. I always feel a sense of connection, not of oblivion, actually. So I don't agree. Sorry.
And your top three...
Top three, that's really difficult because, here's the thing. Mont Ventoux has always been number one. And part of the reason is because it's a very extreme place where I've never once climbed it. I've climbed it somewhere between 50 and 60 times. And I've never once has it been like, I've done this. This is like the last time. I've never once had that feeling. Because of that, it's quite difficult to give a top three because every climb is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It'll never be the same. So obviously there are the exterior factors, but also yourself. You know, have you just done 100, 200, or 10 kilometres? But if I had to, let us put it slightly differently if I can, and let's say... what were my favourite three climbs this year, this summer, then, the Mont Colombis, the Northern Alps, Tim again, he is here, isn't he? Yeah, remember?
Yeah.
We had a big moment there. That is an amazing place. Sorry, yeah, it didn't come across that well, did it? It's an incredible place that God knows why it hasn't been used on a grand tour yet, but thank goodness it hasn't. Let's just keep it for us. The view at the top there is quite exceptional. Then the third time, number two, I would have to include the third of the three ascents we do of the Mont Ventoux on the Mont Ventoux stage, which was that particular time for me was incredibly difficult. And number one, and there is Ben here, was shared this, Jeff, there are several. Sorry, Ben. We had some great climbs together. Ben Cross, this is the Gamonteru in the Asturias. And that is an example. Not only is it an exceptional climb, it's another satellite mask dead end climb. So it's known locally as the evil brother of the Angliru, which is quite a nice title to have. And it's got a concrete finish, and it's got a red and white satellite mask at the top, which is quite a familiar sight for those who know those type of climbs. And it was number one climb of the day. So we were up at the top. We started climbing at probably 7:45 in the morning. The time 2 years before that, we'd done it in a freezing, literally freezing fog. And this time we had one of those mornings you think, I would never wanted to be anywhere else right now at this time. The hardest part of it, of the climb, is the last 2 kilometres, which is the best. And it was one of those moments which you know that you don't even need to have again. You had it once and that's enough.
So, Phil, just on Ventoux, you did it three times, and you said the third time was the toughest because you were having a bad time. But what's the optimum order to do those three roads up? And have you ever varied it when you've done three in the same ride?
So this is a stage that I designed 3 years ago, I think. And it was really the inspiration was just I wanted to do a tribute stage to the Bantu. But one thing I really don't like is I've never been tempted to Everest. I very much respect those who do, but it's just I think I've got so many climbs I want to do that to do the stage just to go back to the bottom and come back up again is not what I choose. So I had to do a stage that was more than just, you know, go up one side of the Ventoux, come back down, then go around and do the other side, whatever. And fortunately, I managed to find a way of doing the three ascents and including a few others just to, you know, give us a proper day out. I remember the first time we had Ben Lieberson, who was a familiar rapper face, with us. And at the end, he said, if only they would do that one day in the tour, that would be the most perfect tour stage. And I had to find a way of doing the Ventoux in the right order. And that had to be finishing from the classic side, from the Bedouin side, that's for sure. So we started, we're on the road at 7:30, I think, from Malassen, so up the north side. And straight down, and we had the procession. It was in August, so we had the procession of tourists had already started, tourist pilgrims, you know, anyone from Team Sky replica kits to people with shopping baskets on the handlebars who were walking after 2 kilometres. And from there, we go into up the Gorge de l'Anesc and come up from the Sault side, which is like the easy side, and then we go over the other side and do a few cols. Called La Suzette, called La Madeleine, bring us round to Bédouin for the final climb. And for me, that stage for me is the ultimate way of experiencing the mountain.
I know Jeremy Whittle's just written a book about Mont Ventoux, and he did put it to the tour organisers that they should organise a great, you know, epic stage going at least twice up Mont Ventoux, and the tour organisers seemed initially to agree and said, yeah, that's great, yeah, you go and tell Mark Cavendish about that. I think the problem is it might be too epic for, not necessarily for the climbers, but for some of the people in the field. Could we maybe have some questions? I'm sure a lot of you have got questions. We'll hand this mic around.
Would you consider doing something like the Indian Pacific race? So not necessarily for racing it, but just to experience time by yourself on a bike for, you know, a few weeks with endured days, you know, 18-hour days and things like that.
18.
It's as much as you want to make.
there's one thing that became the biggest challenge of all over the ride, and that was the management of sleep deprivation. You know, I had always tried to aim for 6 hours a night's sleep, and didn't really make it. I got to an extent of mental fatigue that I had my hands on the bars, and I knew I really needed to eat something, and I knew I had a bar in my back pocket, and I couldn't get one of my arms to go and get that. It seems just crazy, but I kept on saying to myself, come on, you've got that right hand. It's just being lazy, sat on that bars, but I've actually got to get it to lift itself up and round the back of my back into my pocket and get out the bar. And this sort of thing would take about between 5 and 10 minutes of constant monologue. And that is not the reason why I wanted to do 1,000 coals. So that's the part of the plan that didn't work. In other words, I love the physical challenge and I love being in the mountains, obviously, but I don't do endurance riding just to prove that I can ride until I drop, sort of thing. And having done, James Herbeck initially referred to when he and I rode Paris-Brest-Paris, we improvised this, it wasn't pre-planned, but we decided to try and do a time. So we ended up having done it with 2.5 hours sleep over 3 days and 3 nights. And we both hallucinated on the third night. And, you know, I feel lucky that we survived that and came through. But like I say, I think that's another discipline. I have enormous respect for people who do that. It's interesting, Mark Beaumont's ride is something that I feel I could never do. Someone posted a rather sarcastic post, I remember, saying, come on, Phil, there's another guy riding at the moment. After 6 days, he's in Russia. You've been on the road for 2 months and you're still in France. What's going on? we're on two different types of, this vast spectrum of our sport.
Phil, how hard was it to adjust to going home?
So it's an interesting question. It's one I expected and have been asked, but it's still very interesting to answer because. So what we did plan was that Claire would be at the finish and that we actually took 5 days to drive home, which we could have done in like a day. And it was almost like a spaceman coming back from outer space, and we needed that transition time. There was a pretty obvious sort of physical and emotional transition period of sort of coming down, as it were. That didn't really make it any easier when I got the full slap in the face from real life, which was, then seeing my kids and grandchildren for the first time, and I sort of come in and, oh, you're back, good, yeah, saw the photos, amazing, right, looked great, and that was it. So that was right. Now I'm back in the real world, and that took a bit to adjust because you inevitably spend a long time on the road, surrounded by people giving you more compliments than you usually deserve in life, and that's quite nice, really.
Is that it now? What next? 1500 goals, 2000.
Is that it? Is that it? Are you satisfied now? What next? What for your 70th birthday?
Trouble is that Claire is here. Someone did say what next, and I remember being very bemused listening to your interview with Mark Beaumont, and he said that someone on the very finishing line said to him what next, and he probably nearly punched that person, because that's a really... Right afterwards, that is the last thing you want to hear. And fortunately, even now, it's something that actually, I'm not even going towards that hook with that bait on. Sorry, Simon. I'm enjoying a peace of mind that comes from hopefully kind of satisfying that appetite for the experience in the extreme, so I want to carry on sharing the mountains with riders, and I want to make sure that the event stays with the same spirit that it has over the last 9 years, but probably do that in a more balanced way in relation to a life and a sustainable marriage.
You're doing four next year, is that right? Four.
Yeah.
I think you'll enjoy them more, having not without the pressure that you put yourself under this year.
Yes, for sure.
I know I'm not in the audience, but I've got another question. Whereabouts do you live? And when you're doing your normal cycling and you can't go up big coals, what do you get the same thing from cycling when it's kind of ordinary cycling, or is it a different experience for you?
Yeah. Well. Ordinary cycling for me is 50 kilometres with 1,000 metres of climbing. That's what I do, that's where I live. With Walter over there, we do a few of those a day before breakfast. Yeah. That's a joke.
it was sounding so reasonable.
I'm very lucky, but it's not entirely by chance that I live in a fantastic part of the world for cycling, in the Belgian Ardennes, southern Belgium. And there are a few people in this room who've come and ridden with Walter and I in that area. And for me, it is just a perfect training ground for riding in the mountains. and mainly because of the variety of climbs and the intensity of them. In other words, you know, you don't do a climb and then do 10K on the flat till the next one. It's like up and down, relentless. And that is what I love doing. So it's quite easy to maintain form and probably most importantly, to maintain enjoyment of that. You know, it's not something I have to do. Being at home and doing the stuff at home is the bit I have to do.
And on that note, I think we give a big round of applause to Phil. Thank you.